It's good for one's practice, that is to say, about one's development, that is to say, about one's allowing the emergence of your authentic self, to reflect on what we human beings really are and the consequences of that. For Zen is a very radical, life-giving activity. And it's hard for many people to access it once even they discover it and sit in the Zendo. So it's important to look at what we human beings are. Many things characterize a human being, certain biological things that have continuity with other organisms, and so on. But one thing that characterizes a human being uniquely is the sense of having a separative consciousness. That is to say, a consciousness that is able to reflect on the world, including the person's self, and for the benefit of the person's survival, which of course is why it was nurtured in its arising in our ancestors, it creates time, and it creates things, and it creates generalizations and maps about the world and movies and so on in the mind that help one to navigate through the world and be more secure. Now, however, we have inherited that apparatus. And now it is the whole history of the world can be viewed very simply as the products of our propensity to create out of the undiscovered, indivisible world things and beings and evaluate these and evaluate ourselves with respect to certain criteria, all of which are arbitrary, all of which may have had some survival value back in our earlier times. And indeed, now we are not very far from those times because we still act tribally. Is what we think is true of that person indicative of their membership in our tribe or not? And if we have sufficient internal restraints, we don't kill that person if he's a mismatch. But if we don't, then we kill him. We know this happens in the world rampantly. We are not very far from this very primitive utilization of this fundamental human characteristic. It comes from a benevolent place. We want to understand. We want to know. But we settle for what our automatic mind, that is the mind that is able to generalize and is able to name and so on, is able to do, rather than discover new ways. Now, a new way, rather than accept that one's quick generalization about the world and people is the actual fact, which is what happens for most people. We can, and this is one of the great revolutions in human evolution, adopt a scientific consciousness, which contains many things, of course, but one of the central things is it checks out any idea that we have, any hypothesis we have, any theory, any map of the world, any movie that we're making that we believe corresponds to how it is, quotes, out there, and check it out. Get more data, evaluate it, and modify it if necessary. This is very beneficial. This is what can lead to a humanizing of human culture. The denial of that as an ongoing function leaves us in primitive tribalism, as we see in many so-called civilized countries, including and maybe especially our own country. Now that's only part of it, but we have to recognize what kind of structure we have as human beings. Now, a part of this is to not accept And this is so profoundly important for Zen, to not accept, put great doubt upon any conclusion that we have about the world and about ourselves. Even though it may be supported by the mass of people living in our culture and our time, our tribal members and so on. It is almost crazy, it is so commonplace to agree upon the individual separate natures of trees and plants and animals and human beings and fences and roads and stones and all the rest of it. And neglect, even from an observational viewpoint, the continuity that they all represent. That there is no isolated individual anywhere in the world, be they human being, animal, plant, cloud, road, stone, tree, whatever it may be, there is no isolated individual. This is a very benevolent use of our analytical mind. But again, this process of creating ideas instead of encountering the actual sensory-based reality is so strong that we settle for that as an interesting idea versus as a step along the road to that mysterious thing which in Zen we speak of as liberation. Now, Zen is paradoxical. It goes against all common sense because it invites us to examine things that everybody, almost everybody of course, but everybody takes for granted. Even though just the slightest analysis shows that it's absolutely fallacious. That you have a self, that you are really separate, that a tree is really separate from the earth and from the animals and from the foundation of this planet and so on and so on. We've been through this a lot. You understand. But to take the consequences further is essential. This, the power of great doubt is enormously important. Not only in humanizing the planet, apart from anything about liberation, but also for this process of encountering what Zen has to offer and coming to what we call liberation, realization, knowing. Zen is unique in the world in that it carries this process to the end and encourages the students that undertake the path to go to the very end. Fundamentally, this is the only way to find out and really know and liberate ourselves from all the things that scare the shit out of people. Notably death. Now, I think it's very important for the arising of compassion, for the arising of humility in ourselves, and for the arising of devotion to this work, to see this planet and all its people, the so-called biosphere that surrounds in a very, very thin layer this mass of insentient rock and magma. This very thin layer. And even thinner, what Teilhard de Chardin used to call the noosphere, which is a part of the biosphere. The biosphere is all the living things. The noosphere is the surrounding of this planet by understanding mind. From the Greek word nous, meaning one of the three words they had for mind. To see the enormous consequences of the operation, the rampant, unchecked, unexamined operation of this mind that creates duality. within individuals, of course, about the self, about what should have happened in the past, about what they hope for in the future, and disappointment when it doesn't happen. You know all the consequences of this rampant duality. And the treatment of other people. The poignant, the sad, the tragic treatment of other people. Be founded upon this simple but unrecognized error of thinking that the beings in the world around you, that you really know them, and that they are the characters in the movie in your mind. That they are errant, that they are unworthy of existence. That you know what is going on inside them enough that you can be their judge. And you can exercise that judgment in simple ways, criticism, gossip. And notice the precept that we have in Buddhism that is not found in Christianity or Judaism and so on, or Islam, about gossip. It is not, the world does not exist for us to comment on. Yet that's how we treat it very often. What do you think of that? Well, that's weird. They shouldn't have done that. Why don't they just realize that? That's a crazy place to plant a tree. I wonder when they're going to get a new car and not go around in that rattle trap. On it goes. We know all about these people. We have a right to talk about them in that way. Because we are so elementary that we haven't examined this process within ourselves that rampantly keeps recreating the beings surrounding us and ourselves as things, as objects. Not as, even if we allow the individuality of them, not as magnificent individuals, unique each in themselves. But even more profound, as manifestations of this one reality. People don't know anything about that one reality. We are so elementary. We are so in need of this process of the examination of our trap, the way in which we encage ourselves. It's useful to do that. As I say, because it builds compassion. It builds humility in oneself. It builds devotion to the work. And it builds the habits of examining and learning from our unique karma, what occurs for us every moment, whether the emotional responses that we have or the chatter that we engage in about the world, the assumptions that we have about ourselves and the world, and even behaviors that derive from those meanings that we put upon the world that we think we understand. What a wonderful thing. If all that could be turned with devotion towards this work, in all its aspects, in the aspects of rational analysis, so that one helps to rid oneself of the fallacies of dualistic thinking, and even more so to the process of unification with a practice. Once one discovers Zen, to make every day, every moment, a place where there is a unification and a manifestation of this practice, that would benefit all beings. As we say in our first vow, all beings, one body, I vow to liberate. It is our minds that create the individuals and place them in bondage. It is we ourselves who place ourselves in bondage. It is to liberate this habit of mind that creates the many out of the one. In a way that is not useful. I can't go into what I have often gone into, that there are many ways to create the many out of the one that serve the ends that correspond to our karmic position in the world. But we are talking about something very different here. We are talking about the encasement that exists around human beings that blocks them from encountering the world as it is, not the world as we make it up, not the world that is our internal map, our internal movie, which we project upon the world and comfort ourselves with really understanding what the world is like and what people are like. Now, this capsule is what is one of the things that it's all about. This capsule needs somehow to have chinks in it, little openings. And that there has to be some knowledge of how to utilize these openings. This is the nature of human beings. There are very often, well, I won't say very often, there are sometimes ways in which chinks are made in this structure. Its fallibility, its inadequacy, and so on, are revealed. And we get a sight, a perception of something that is not this capsule. But without tools, without a tradition, we don't know what to do with it. For example, something that one hears, maybe a lecture, but maybe also certain pieces of music. I know that there are some who have made a chink in this armor by hearing, for example, the last quartet of Beethoven. It reduces them from the rigidity and opens a gate. It can. There are many for whom there is not the readiness to have that happen, and it's fine, it's okay. But for some, that is what can happen. Sometimes it's an unexpected kind word, a being treated in a way that it was quite unexpected, unexpected because you yourself might have thought of yourself as being such and so, worthy of criticism, unworthy, knowing it all, goodness knows, there was some image that one had of oneself, and yet there is a kind, unexpected acceptance or manifestation of unconditionality towards one that can at that moment soften one and once again open a little chink so that one can experience what we might call universal compassion or the trustworthiness of something that you didn't know existed. Also, pain and suffering can be one that can open a little chink. Unavoidable, unmitigated pain from some physical means, some emotional source. And that can drive one into a place where one realizes there is nothing whatsoever that one can do about it. And when that is realized, that too can make a little chink. And one can receive a comfort, a hint at something quite different from this pain that gives one hope or promise. But once again, without the supportive means, that too, as time passes along, enables this traditional, ingrained, dualistically thinking mind to package that as an experience. Oh, I remember the great time that I heard that music. It was really, just really wonderful. And oh, by the way, Joel was there and Mary too, and we had a nice bottle of wine, and it was, it's packaged now. It's gone. It's placed in some shelf somewhere. Boy, that was really severe pain. My goodness, I didn't think I'd ever get over it. Something happened. I don't know, it just turned around somehow. And oh well, I'm glad it's past now. The mind packages it. It does not utilize it. It is not ready and alert for things to use and to have a means to use them. This capsule is very characteristic of human beings, and it is almost impervious. People, after many years, step away from the actual experiences of life as being sources of a new way, sources of learning, into safely packaging all these things and putting them on shelves. Going through life with this tenuous comfort that comes from understanding one's life. Now this is our human condition. Into this space steps in and offers something which, for people who undertake this process of sitting and so on, provides for most people, again, an opportunity to misunderstand it. And an opportunity to package it. I'll always remember when we had our Sharon Springs Zen Center, of this woman who came to the center, and after a couple of days of living in our community, she came to me and she said, again, I forget the exact words, but it was equivalent to, I like it here, and so in the morning, and at noon, and in the evening, we go to the Zendo, and we sit on the cushions, and we follow our breath. It's in breath, out breath. So that's the gig, right? Always remember the phrase. So that's the gig, right? I saw her some years later. She had certain, what do we say, adventures in our community, including crashing her neighbor's car and so on. I saw her some years later when I was out in Colorado, and I was at the mime school in Colorado, and she was there too. Interesting. Funny world. Anyhow, she was wandering, as they say, from pillar to post, what to do with life. She had developed certain styles. But it's looking around for, like, what's the gig? What's the next interesting thing to do? Oh, yeah, I've done that. Oh, yeah, I know about that. Let me tell you about it. Very few people. We say in Zen, one out of 1,000. That's probably an exaggeration. That has the, first of all, spiritual intelligence, which means the ability to respond to that which is beyond words. And that encounter a situation, and you know the story of the blind turtle, to encounter a situation where there's the possibility of contacting the Dharma, and the possibility of being guided in it, and the possibility of having the opportunity to practice the Dharma is very rare. But there are those few that undertake it and follow through, but all the way along, this human condition comes in, the human condition of packaging things, misinterpreting it, and to some of us, making us sad that things are misrepresented in that way. But there it is. This is our human condition. The best we can do is to do our best with our, as Voltaire said, to cultiver son jardin, to cultivate your own garden. Do as well as you can. All beings, one body. I vow to liberate. So, this tendency and necessity of this incursion of the products of the dualistic mind, their enormous inertia. Anybody who undertakes the practice of Zen knows about this inertia, knows about the momentum that this mind can have once you give it footing. And this has been known throughout the whole history of Zen, of course. This is about the human condition, not about Japan or China or Korea or whatever. So I want to read and comment this morning on a poem. This is in the Book of Equanimity. It's about Joshua and it's case 57. I'll read the preface first. These, of course, were all the koan were selected from the recorded interactions that masters had with students or other masters, and they were valued because they had within them some kind of kernel that helped us. That was something that could be applied and worked with. And so, in that case, there is a preface to the group of students who are encountering these and using them in this organized way, the way the koan system is organized. So this preface goes like this. Fiddling with shadows, toiling with forms. It is not understood that forms are the basis for shadows. So just to pause for a minute, that means that instead of getting a bigger mind about things, we play with the individual things. As we say in Zen, we try to cut off the leaves of the tree rather than going to the roots. And of course it's a futile activity and can only lead to despair and despondency that I guess it's just not working, or maybe I'm just the kind of person for whom, and so on and so on. It substantiates one's stories, one's scenarios, one's themes of life, and so on. So we fiddle with shadows and toil with forms. It's not understood that forms are the basis for shadows. Then he goes on and says, raising the voice to quiet an echo. It is not known that the voice is the root of the echo. As much like, damn it, I've got to stop that mind. It's so goddamn annoying in there. Just natters on about stuff. I've had enough of this. Shut up, mind. Get out of here. I'll raise a sword up onto your tree. That's supposed to work. Raising the voice to quiet an echo. It's not known that the voice is the root of the echo. If you try to deal with duality within duality, it's hopeless. And then he goes on saying, don't ride an ox to look for an ox. That may or may not be good advice. May take an ox to recognize an ox. But anyhow, this is using a wedge to remove a wedge. How can you avoid this error? So these prefaces are setting up the case that people will be attentive about this particular domain, the domain here of using improper tools, tools that won't work, to deal with these things that are recognized as obstructions in our being. So here's how it goes. Attention. Venerable Genyo asked Joshua, where there is not one thing, what then? What does that mean when there is not one thing? Probably Genyo thought that his mind was totally purified. He goes, okay, now what? So he comes to Joshua. When there is not one thing, what then? Joshua replied, throw it away. Genyo said, with not one thing, what is there to throw away? And Joshua remarked, then carry it off. Now, it's not difficult to see that this man, Genyo, for all his attainment, was still plagued by a mind that labeled things, that made of certain things a unique kind of experience. There's a koan elsewhere in the Heikkei Roku that goes something like this. Yakujo was asked by a monk, what is the most wonderful thing in the world? And Yakujo said, to sit alone on this sublime mountain peak. And the mount bowed low. And Joshua gave him a whack. What's that about? Clearly, Joshua was responding to this monk and using everything as a teaching place, as optimally we try to do. Not always successful, but that's what we try to do. So, when this monk asks, what is the most wonderful thing? Yakujo knew where he was going. What he really had in mind. And so he answered him, validating what was in the monk's mind. To have this enlightenment and to live this enlightenment, this state where you see only one thing and there's nothing else in the world on this sublime mountain peak. And the monk, having received the answer that he really knew was the right answer, bowed and got a terrific whack from Yakujo. Now, this is a very common thing in the so-called spiritual world. You see it all around. In America, in India, I've seen it so many places. As soon as people undertake what's called a spiritual path, capital S, they think it's about leading to this acquisition of some kind of state of being that is like so superior as to be beyond all these trivialities. And in the minds of people that haven't experienced it, it is sometimes called being a saint or being whatever they want to call it. Zen, with its wonderful hundreds of years long refined wisdom, has, as you know, the Zen circle, which is not universally known in Zen traditions, but I think it's a very, very important thing to give the kind of perspective and to illustrate what Joshua is talking about here. So you have reached, and of course Yakujo too, with his whack to the monk, you have reached this realization of one reality. You have gotten a deep insight into who and what you are and what the world is. You may have even started to realize the way in which this mind projects separation onto the world. That it is totally and absolutely a creation of us human beings. You may even have encountered directly some of the so-called external reality. You may have picked up a leaf or fallen on the ground or done anything that was a direct contact and had that as a moment of awakening for you. All these things might have happened. And they substantiate this idea that you have arrived. Then says you've only gone halfway around the circle. We say in Zen, somewhat humorously, that the saint is a cripple. There's only one leg. Only half the work is done. And that's why I sometimes say to people, although I kind of keep it quiet much of the time because I don't want to be discouraging to people, that Zen practice begins upon awakening. And so there's a movement further around the circle. You learn how to live in the world with not having duality as the basis of your living. You learn how to use duality without being used by it, and without according a reality to this dualistic world, which it does not have intrinsically. And so there is a period, not precisely delineated, from 180 to 70, as we go around the circle, where a lot of new things are learned. And it's new ways to be in the world and view the world, and it comes back to experiencing and expressing within one's being. Always, of course, with the foundation of attention. Presence. And then from 270 to 360, it's returning to the world as given now. Not the world of Tang Dynasty China. Not the world of feudal Japan. Not the world of the 50s in America. The world now. What is so now? And most certainly now, in this moment. How to deal with this world is part of the training of Zen that allows one to manifest what was certainly a glorious peak, to use Yakucho's phrase. But it was only the beginning. Now one has to shake off, liberate oneself from those things which encapsulated you and that you thought innocently was actually what the world is. That there are isolated individuals and that there is time and that there is a future that one can misuse and that there is a past that could have been different. And on it goes. You step into knowing how wonderful the simple work is of just walking upon the earth, breathing the air. You really hear and see. And you can really accord with the flow of your particular karma without objection, riding the waves. And certainly, having no fear of this so-called death of the individual. This is a summary of the training. And it was awakening, trying to awaken a person to that necessity and get that monk that Yagacho hit out of the having packaged this ideal state. Because when you do that, it sours. It's no longer living. So that's why we say in the practice of Zen, whatever you experience along the way, be they great insights or little insights, those little ones that, as Hakuin so nicely said, the little insights that make you dance. to see them as scenery, not to disregard them, to experience them, to cherish them, to experience them at the moment, but not to stop, to keep your feet moving. Keep your feet moving with that trust that was hopefully the source of that original realization. It was the thing that made you decide, whatever it takes, I want this authenticity, I really want to know. I don't want to settle anymore for understanding. And that carries you. That carries you. It's like a momentum of a new sort within you. It carries you as long as you are attentive, as long as you have your alertness about you to catch the saboteurs coming in. Not to push them away anymore, not to be angry at them, not to do anything, but to realize each moment is a moment for learning. And that's what we human beings have to do. They are all moments for learning. And so Joshu says to Genyo, when there's not one thing, what then? And Joshu says, throw it away. But Genyo didn't get it. This was too precious to him. He couldn't throw it away. Because he didn't understand that he had packaged it. And that he was talking of an it, that therefore it was a package. And he wasn't going to throw this package away because it was too wonderful. So Joshua says, carry it off. What if, with not one thing, what is there to throw away? He doesn't realize that to say not one thing is to delineate it as a package. The very fact that his dualistically thinking mind had come in and encapsulated that made him ask, what do you do now? Because he had already placed it behind him as a possession or as an adornment, but not as a living reality that was a humble foundation. I say humble because these experiences of awakening to us often bring a sense of humility that we really don't know. We have to preserve that not knowing. That is a way to allow the experience of, we might say, the other side of the coin, the other fundamental nature of the world, whatever words we could put on what awakening is, as an ongoing presence and an ongoing nurturance for our life. Because the dualistic mind is so ready to come in and say, well, I understand. This was that. And it's doing it. It's walling it off. It's building. It's repairing the capsule. Now adding a little bit of golden wallpaper to the capsule. But it's still repairing the capsule because its vested interest is in what the thousands of years have meant for survival of their ancestors in the human race by creating maps of the world that were useful to discern saber-toothed tigers and enemy tribes and all those sorts of things. But they are being used by it, not having it as a tool to use. The toolkit has to be separated and its automatism has to be disempowered in order that you can take oneself into this next phase of being a real human being on the planet. So Joshua benignly says, then carry it off. And as you carry it off, you engage in a learning process. So you realize that everything that occurs for you is potentially a beneficial thing for your ongoing life development. On the one hand, you can utilize your powerful analytical mind by looking at it carefully, saying, what's really going on when I had that anxiety? need to learn something about the mind. What's really going on when I had that guilt? I thought I'd be free of guilt now that I've had that awakening experience. What's really going on? And maybe you look at it, maybe you see that guilt entails an ancient habit. If there's something you don't like about yourself, about your cat, your dog, yourself, a child, you hit it. That'll enable them to learn not to do it, won't it? Bad. You look at it and you go, yeah, this is pretty primitive, all right. No evidence that I have now that it really works. Besides, it's based on the idea that I'm not okay the way I am and I ought to be the way the standard is. We all know that stuff. But then also you look at guilt and you see there's a criterion in there of the kind of behavior that you want to have. So you examine that. Is this still a criterion that's worth holding on to? And if it's something like, not misusing people and so on, and you felt guilty because you felt you had misused somebody, then that's a criterion worth holding on to. Other criteria might not, I ate one of the apples which my parents were saving for the company. I feel really guilty about it. Well, maybe that's not such an important criterion to hold on to. So you examine, you learn. And then, especially, there's the idea in guilt that things could have been different in the past. If only I was so stupid too. You examine carefully that whole allegation. You realize whatever happens at any moment, past, present, or in the future, will be the result of the causes and conditions that are impinging upon that moment, and the stack of causes that has the most going for it is the one that's going to result in the behavior, the external manifestation, be it words or action. And you learn until you can then look at it and go, I understand you, guilt. And you get the feeling that happens as it creeps in. As you do that, the great power of observation that is part of the essence of ongoing Zazen, witnessing, helps to drop it off, and in no time, it's no longer something that comes in and bothers you, moves you, occupies yourself, detracts you from a direct encounter, a growing ability to have a direct encounter with the actual life of the present moment. So likewise, anything that comes into your being, so likewise with pain. Is this pain a real signal that I have to do something about it? Is it the result of some dire thing like a heart attack, a stroke, appendicitis, whatever it may be, an abscess in the tooth, gum, whatever it is? Then you go and your nearest opportunity and get something done about it. But sometimes pain is not the result of that. It's the result of using things such as tendons and muscles that have not previously had much use. And sometimes it's from genetic things, certain things that occur in the back, certain things that occur elsewhere in the body that have had causes that have, that they arise, but they're not something that is a signal for something that needs to be done about them, and so on. You examine everything, and find if it's something that you have to, that you find how to deal with it, that's an appropriate way. This is all the foundation of all this is caring for yourself. Caring for yourself does not mean coddling yourself. But it means the realization of your unique, precious being, like that of all beings. You just don't do certain things to you anymore. Just as you wouldn't do them to other people. Because fundamentally you're learning more and more that all we beings are like two hands of one body. The left hand would never hurt the right hand. Except, of course, in some extreme form of duality, where people do cut themselves and do various things to hurt themselves because they are so deeply divided. But as one moves along on this path, one realizes more and more, and the same thing is true of so-called objects outside ourselves. That's why, see, that's why you close a door carefully. Because there's only one reality here. And the way in which you deal with any part of the reality leaves its imprint on your being and leaves you in a propensity towards disregarding certain things. So, but if you are attentive at all times, as best, of course, your ability, as best you can, then you realize that you really are living within one reality. And that one reality includes not denigrating part of it, not diminishing part of it, not saying that's important, this is not important. That somehow it's all equal. And of course one pays attention to the pressures of time sometimes and all of that. But that fundamentally in one's attitude of walking and living through the world, there's that sense of the equality of all things. This is all learning. This is part of what Joshu means by carrying it off. If you can't just discard it, just let it go, then you carry it off. You keep it with you and you make it a learning thing until it falls organically away from you. Until it's done its sufficient benevolent work for you of being an opportunity for learning. And all along the way, for yourself as for all beings, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing worthy of criticism of someone having a certain thing going on for them. And make no mistake that you don't add on to it by assuming that you know what that thing is that is going on for them. Nobody really knows another's life. It's very, very rare for individuals to take the time and have the tools to find out gently and respectfully about the life of another and to start to know it by stepping into it. This, you have to recognize the power of this other mind, the mind with the inertia and momentum of creating duality. It's so much easier to make an image that you understand something, whether it be about a tree or about another person, or yourself, than it is to actually take the time to learn and to allow to drop off those habitual ways of thinking. For the sake of what? For the sake of your life. And that includes the life of all beings. As you do this with your own life, that is, the life that you are most consciously aware of, in that mystery of being a participant in this one great reality, but having special sense organs and abilities in this little island, we speak of it that way, but it's just a metaphor. We don't know what it is. So it's okay to use the word I. This is not violating anything. Just realize you don't know what that is. There is some mysterious thing here. And you can never figure it out. That's like as the preface to this koan says, raising the voice to quiet an echo, or fiddling around with shadows and toiling with forms, fiddling around as books are filled with it, to define the I and what the ego is, and postulate non-ego states and all that goes. It may have some use somewhere, but basically in this work, it has no use. It is fiddling with the shadows and forms rather than going to the roots. And also being able to admit there's things we do not know about. Because we try to use a dualistically framed mind to understand that which is non-dual. To do so with that mind means you have to step outside of it and create of it as an it. And that immediately means that anything you do with that so-called it, that is to say my real self or whatever it is that you've postulated as an it, is going to be fallacious. Because you've separated yourself from it, and the only way to know it is by entering into it. That is partly why in the koan work that we teach, all these koan have to be accompanied by a demonstration of with the whole being to get into the habit of entering into life rather than distancing oneself from it and talking about it. It does not deny the ability nor the value of talking about certain things. But in this work, it has to be realized. This is the work of encountering and finally stepping into and living from the non-dual. Now, this is a wonderful teaching behind this simple koan. When there's nothing at all in the mind, what then? Throw it away. Well, if there's nothing at all in the mind, what is there to throw away? Then carry it off. Work with it. It's important to get hip about what this whole thing is all about, this work that we call Zen. When you do, and when you participate in it in these fashions, it becomes, at every stage along the way, every single stage along the way, it becomes alive. And that is the significance of it. Where there is authentic Zen throughout history, there has been life. Where there is, what do we say, that which is called Zen, and it occurred in China, and it occurred in Japan, and it occurs in America today. There is no life. There is empty ritual. There is pretense, pretending, acting as if, because we are so in America addicted to appearance. So we look for the gate. You wear this kind of robe and you do this sort of things, right? Is that the gate? It's sad when you see that within a tradition that is meant to bring life to human beings and brings nothing but more of the same, more of the pretense, more of the entertainments. But that's the way it is, isn't it? That's the way we are, we human beings on the planet. And the Buddha predicted that there were four stages after his death and before Maitreya comes. And we happen, in the traditional counting of years, to be in the last phase, which is the phase of the hard-to-find Buddhism. Well, be that as it may, we've all found some. Let's use it well. We'll end there today.